Now, I hate filling in forms, and I particularly hate those forms that ask you to say a bit about yourself. You know the ones which you have to sort of list your interests, your hobbies, your strengths and weaknesses, that sort of thing, a nightmare. And if you've recently moved to London, perhaps to study, then the horrors of the UCAS form are probably still with you. So I'm fairly reluctant to remind you, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I don't know what you put on yours, but I recently came across these excerpts from an actual application form for New York University. It was written by a bloke called Hugh Gallagher, and this is how he filled in the final box where it required applicants to say anything additional about themselves, anything that might assist with their application. Well, this is what he wrote. I am a dynamic figure. That's him, not me, by the way. Often seen scaling walls and crushing ice. I've been known to remodel train stations in my lunch breaks, thus making them more energy efficient. I woo women with my sensuous and godlike trombone playing. I'm an expert in bricklaying, a veteran in love, and an outlaw in Peru. I'm an abstract artist, a concrete analyst, and a ruthless bookie. Fashion critics the world over swoon over my original line of corduroy evening wear. I can hurl tennis rackets at small moving objects with deadly precision, and consequently have performed several covert operations for the CIA. Years ago, I actually discovered the meaning of life, but unfortunately forgot to write it down. I breed prize-winning clams. I've won bullfights in San Juan, cliff-diving competitions in Sri Lanka, and spelling bees at the Kremlin. I have played Hamlet, performed open-heart surgery, and I have spoken to Elvis. I am 18 years old next month. Now, I wonder, would you give this man a university place? It has been said that the closest people, most people get to writing creative fiction is when they write their CV. And so if Hugh Gallagher had been applying for a creative writing course, then I'd give him a place straight away. For anything else, well, I'd probably want to interview him first. But you can perhaps understand why he did it. It certainly draws one's attention to him, doesn't it? Yeah, he would have stood out a mile against the thousands of applicants to that university. And it's dog-eat-dog out there, isn't it? You have to scramble to wrestle your way through to get noticed and to succeed in modern cities like New York or London. That's what you've got to do. After all, how else are you going to get a job in such a competitive market as this? As the influential thinker Charles Handy put it, the motto of employers today seems to be, don't count on us, count on yourself. We'll only help if we can. Don't count on us, count on yourself. Now, that might be received wisdom for surviving life in the big smoke, but what about life in the ever after? Or to put it another way, is that the way into God's good books? What sort of spiritual CV or resume do you need to get a leg up in the God department? That was something Jesus found himself talking about rather a lot. He was a pretty influential thinker too, and one that's influenced people down the centuries and across the globe. But more than that, he's actually offended quite a lot as well. And the funny thing is that he offends not always the people you'd expect to get offended. He has a really interesting habit of taking the wrong side and offending those you'd expect him to get along with, which I think we'll find is quite an encouraging thing in a funny sort of way. Jesus here tells a story. He was often doing that. Stories can lull people into a sort of false sense of security. After all, a little bit of creative writing never did anyone any harm, did it? So we get the story's dedication at the start, verse 9. Now, instead of writing this for great Aunt Agatha to thank her for all the help in creative processes, this story is told, verse 9, for those who are confident of their own righteousness. Well, what's all that about then? Well, basically, becoming righteous is about getting into God's good books. Having righteousness is about being good enough for God, having the correct tick boxes on the spiritual CV. That's the context. So what's the received wisdom from this 2,000-year-old thinker? Well, his story is about two blokes praying in the ancient Jewish temple in Jerusalem. No surprises there. And an everyday event 2,000 years ago. Happened all the time. But don't think its age makes this story irrelevant. It's as influential today as it ever was. Now, let's think about the first bloke. And I called him a man who could do no wrong. We're told in verse 10 that he was a Pharisee. Now, don't jump to conclusions. If you've heard that word before, and many haven't these days, but if you have, you'll assume you know what that means, that he's a bad guy. Well, in Jesus' day, that couldn't be further from the truth. A Pharisee was a pretty impressive kind of guy, one of the good guys. And we forget that if we're not careful. These guys were the religious creme de la creme. They took being good more seriously than anybody else, and they were hugely respected for it. In a way, they earned the sort of respect that a Mother Teresa or a Dalai Lama have today. They were impressive. They had the integrity to live out what they believed, often at great personal cost, and certainly with great personal discipline. Don't knock them. They were the sort of people who you'd be impressed by, but you'd think, well, I could never live like that. They were awesomely religious. They were the pillars of society, and religious places like the Jerusalem Temple would have been their natural habitat. No wonder this Pharisee oozes confidence, doesn't he, when he stands up to pray. And he had a lot to be confident about. Now, the intriguing thing about this story is that we get to be in the rather privileged position of seeing it all from God's point of view and hearing it all from God's point of view. We even get to listen in on the prayers of this man's heart. And they're quite revealing, really. Show me the contents of a man's prayers, and you show me the contents of a man's heart. Now, we tend to pray most about the things that matter most to us, don't we? If we pray at all. So let's see what's on this man's heart. Verse 11. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast a week and give a tenth of all I get. Twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. No, I don't doubt for a minute that he was telling the truth, do you? I mean, he certainly wasn't like robbers and evildoers and adulterers, you name it. It was precisely his integrity and lifestyle that generated the respect that he deserved. And the interesting thing when you analyze it is that he went further than he needed to. Now, the Jewish law recommended fasting once a week in order to devote yourself to things that matter. That was the point of it. But our friend here does it twice. It also said one should tithe or give a tenth of any crops you grow in your fields. Well, this guy gives a tenth of absolutely everything he has. Far more than he needs to. But the key question, and it's a question that often puzzles many non-religious types, is this. Why? Why bother? Why make such a sweat of it? What motivates the uber-religious? After all, perhaps you're one of those people who finds this all pretty alien. I mean, people these days take their religion rather like they take their coffee too often, watered down, particularly if you go to Starbucks. Religion should be convenient rather than demanding, fulfilling rather than costly. Listen to a Rastafarian called Zebi, who said sometime after converting to Rastafarianism from Catholicism, he said this, Rastafarianism is an easy religion to fit into your everyday life. I'm comfortable with it. Well, that's a far cry from our Pharisee friend, isn't it? And the clues to his motivation are all here, even in this tiny prayer. So have a look at it. For a start, what's the focus? Well, we don't actually need to work that out. Jesus tells us, verse 11, he prayed about himself. And that's certainly what we find in this two-sentence prayer. And in many ways, it actually reads rather like a sort of spiritual CV or resume, doesn't it? He's reminding God, as if God might have failed to notice, reminding God of the credit in his spiritual bank account. Now, you'd think God would keep pretty good records, wouldn't you? But the Pharisee just has to remind him just to make sure. This has got the sort of atmosphere of Hugh Gallagher's application to New York University, doesn't it? Except the stakes are higher here. This is basically the Pharisee's application form for heaven. But the most revealing thing about this Pharisee's prayer is it can hardly be called a prayer at all, can it? It's just a statement of fact. Is God impressed? Most people assume so. I mean, God likes good people, doesn't he? I know he's become a bit of a joke these days, but the great theologian and former boxer Chris Eubank sometimes come out with some quite classic comments. He said this, I have no vices. I am a hero. Go and look it up in the dictionary and you'll find a picture of me. But fascinatingly, after Eubank converted from Christianity to Islam, he said this, I was on my mother's knee in church, so I was brought up with God being the cornerstone of my life. And my understanding of Islam is that if you're a good Christian, then you're a good Muslim. Now, some would not agree with this view. However, this is my view. And this is the point. So as long as you believe in doing good and not promoting badness, then you are God's man or woman. So there you have it. God likes good people, according to Chris Eubank. And many others. Do good, don't promote badness. God's got to be impressed with that, hasn't he? Now, whether or not Eubank or the Pharisee succeed in impressing God, there is often a rather nasty twist to all this, a sort of flip side, and you get a hint of it in Jesus' reason for telling the story there in verse 9. It's for those who are confident of their own righteousness and, notice, who tend to look down on everybody else. Now, the Pharisee may well have been telling the truth about what he'd done, but look at the attitude it breeds. Verse 11, God, I thank you. But I'm not like other people. Criminals, riffraff, this scumbag tax collector over there at the back. We wince at that, don't we? The problem is, and I think this is a real problem, how do you avoid this sort of pitfall if you're religious? How do you avoid it? I mean, if you're sweating so hard to be good, how can you not feel like this about those who couldn't care less about being good? And that's the whole point. It makes you better than them. It's the perennial problem with the Pharisees' approach to life. It always sets you apart. It always invites comparison, both in yourself and in others. The religious person thinks, thank God I'm better than them. And the rest will think, I just could never be like them. Just as Andrew was explaining earlier how he felt before he came to know the Lord Jesus. He says, I couldn't be like that. So does this impress God? Well, let's see how Jesus handles the other guy in the temple, and the contrast is absolute. I've called him a man who could do no right. Certainly what he felt like. Now, tax collectors in those days were worse than you think. Now, of course, everyone's wary of the likes of people who work for the Inland Revenue or the TV licensing detector vans. But give them a break. Those guys, give them a chance. They're just doing their jobs. And I say that to keep them sweet, because I know one or two come to All Souls. But in Jesus' day, they were the scum. They were collaborators, traitors, working for the enemy, the Roman occupying powers. Not only that, but these guys would frequently top up the taxes with a few unofficial commissions and nudge-nudge administrative fees, which went straight into their pockets. Not a nice bunch. If the Pharisees were respected, tax collectors were reviled, and with good reason. And if the temple was a place a Pharisee felt at home in, that could never be said for a tax collector. Even entering the gate was a big deal for him. It would have taken real courage. No wonder we find in verse 13 that he's standing at the back with his head bowed. The classic pose of the man who doesn't want to be noticed. Perhaps there's some tonight who feel like that here. A church perhaps is the last place you'd ever expect to find yourself. Well, All Souls has many advantages. One of them is that it's big enough to hide in and be anonymous if you need to. And that's fine. That's okay. It's certainly what the tax collector would have wanted. He'd have been mortified to have known that the arch-comparison meister, the Pharisee, had spotted him. But he wanted to be there because he knew he had to. Now, his prayer wasn't impressive. Plain-speaking words from a plain-speaking man. You won't find him spouting out the sort of formal language of the King James Bible or some other set of religious scriptures. Instead, he just blurts it out. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Well, the prayer is addressed to the same person as the Pharisees, God, but that's where the similarities stop. For a start, this is actually a prayer, a desperate prayer. The only statement about himself is just one word, sinner. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Here we go. Preacher out on a guilt trip again. Christians always banging on about sin, always out to make people feel bad. Is that what you're thinking? Well, hang on. I didn't bring it up first. Don't blame me. It's what this tax collector said in the story. And notice, he's not saying it because the Pharisee's giving him a hard time. He's barely noticed the Pharisee. No, he's simply coming to terms with something inescapable about himself. And it seems to be precisely this realization which took him to the temple in the first place, despite it being the last place he would normally want to spend any time in. Because, you see, just like we were hearing from Andrew earlier, he was someone who just felt he could never be good enough for God. He just couldn't manage it. He could do no right, as far as God was concerned. Now let's be clear here, you see, a sinner is not simply someone who does lots of bad things. Get that straight out of your head. Which might come as a bit of a surprise, mightn't it? As far as the Bible and Jesus are concerned, sin is about, well, it's about attitude. It's about living a life without depending on God, a life without listening to God, a life without being concerned about God, a life without accountability to God. Basically, a life lived independently of God. Now, all kinds of things might sort of flow on from that. It might lead to one being the biggest rebel on the street, in and out of police cells, courtrooms, and rehab clinics. Or, and this is the really surprising thing, it might lead one to being none of those things at all. It might even make one religious. For what the religious person and the rebel both have in common is the same attitude. Me, me, me. And not God, God, God. Think back to the Pharisee's prayer. It was all about himself. God hardly featured at all. God's name is almost, well, it's more like a punctuation mark at the start, isn't it? Well, he himself is the focus for the whole thing. He's trying to earn his way to God by being good. That's why he lists all these things that he's done, just to make sure God's got it straight. Tick, tick, tick. What the Pharisee's not come to terms with is the simple fact that that's impossible. For how good is good enough? Quite good? Reasonably good? Pretty good? The Pharisee might well have fasted twice a week, but did he do that for God or for himself? And how about the way he treated tax collectors? Aren't they human as well? You might be impressed with how seriously he takes his religion, but you could never say he was perfect. Not in his heart, could you? But more frighteningly, it is actually his prayer that proves a life lived without dependence on God, which is pretty much the meaning of sin. Don't count on God, count on yourself kind of life. Yes, this Pharisee was a sinner too. In many ways, no different from the tax collector. Now, I suppose the only difference is that the Pharisee thought he could impress God, that his spiritual CV was enough to make him righteous. But God's never impressed by reasonably good. His standards are absolute. Well, of course they are. How could they not be? How could they be anything else? You might have heard of Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the second Secretary General of the United Nations soon after the Second World War. And he was a deeply committed public servant. And W.H. Auden, the poet, described him as a great, good, and lovable man. A man of integrity, by all accounts. An impressive world leader. Just the sort of person you would want in that sort of influential position. Someone you can trust. But this is what he said about himself. This great, good, and lovable man. He said this. He bemoaned what he called that dark counter-center of evil in our nature. And in particular, the perversity that makes our unselfish service of others the foundation of our own self-esteem. In other words, I feel good about myself because I help you. A bit of a tricky one, that one, isn't it? Because how do you not? I begin to think, hey, what a good boy am I? Because I help you out. Dag Hammarskjöld recognized the reality of this thing that the Bible calls sin, even in himself. And if others think a person is great, there always lurks a darkness of heart that we cannot completely hide or eradicate. It's not putting people on a guilt trip to talk about this. It's simply about waking up to reality. It's about looking in the spiritual mirror and admitting that we're a long way off what we should be. Well, Jesus, tax collector, has looked in the mirror. And he knows in his heart of hearts that he just can't help himself. That there's simply too much water under the bridge. And you can't change the past. In fact, he probably feels he's blown it. It's too late. There's only one thing left. Only one thing when you're desperate. And that's to cry out for help. You've got nowhere else to turn. What else do you do when you realize that your spiritual CV isn't up to very much? And that's precisely what he does in his prayer. He begs for mercy. You only ask for mercy when you have no chips left in the bank. When you have nothing else to bargain with. When you know you're sunk. The Pharisee isn't ready to do that. He thinks he's got enough in the bank already. But this is where Jesus really gets under the skin. And I'm pretty sure that there'll be people here tonight who will find this profoundly offensive. Have a look at verse 14. I tell you that this man, in other words, the tax collector, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Who impresses God then? Well, according to Jesus, it's the compromised tax collector and not the religious Pharisee. And the difference is not that one lived a better life than the other. The difference was that while both were in fact sinners, only one admitted it and asked for help. And help is what he received. For to be justified is simply a posh Bible way of saying made righteous or made right with God, being written into God's good books. That's what it means. And the Pharisee thought he could live a life good enough for God. But God's good enough is perfection, not good enough. That doesn't mean the door is closed to him. Far from it. If the Pharisee is prepared to accept the fact, then there is another way into God's good books, which is why Jesus himself would go on to die on a cross. He died to give us the righteousness that we could never attain for ourselves. He swapped his righteousness for our CV of sin. He died for our sin because that is what sin and rejecting God deserves. But in his place, we are given his spiritual CV of righteousness. There's a swap, something we certainly didn't deserve. The tax collector simply pleaded for mercy. And the miracle is that he found it. He was justified. His name was clearly printed in God's good books. Not because he earned it, but because Jesus gave it. So I'm about to finish. But there is a choice, it's clear. Whether you're religious or rebellious, will you admit your need for help? Or will you follow the received worldly wisdom of don't count on us, count on yourself? Or will you face facts and accept what God offers in Jesus? If you do, it might mean that you suddenly find you're taking God quite seriously. Not out of fear or a fanatical worry about being good enough for God, like the Pharisee, but out of a deep gratitude to him for accepting you even when, in all honesty, you could do no right. Well, that's what it felt. Just as Andrew told us earlier, you may not be quite at that point to accept it all. That's okay, and that's understandable. But please don't let these things drift away. It's too important for that. Check out the Christianity Explored course. And pick up a booklet. I've got some booklets there that I'd be very happy to give you if you wanted to find out more. And I've got some friends who'll be with me at the back afterwards who are only too happy to give you a booklet and perhaps answer a question or two. But the offer that Jesus makes is simply too good just to pass up. You might have heard of Alex Haley, the author of the epic story of Ruth, about the West African slaves transported to the Americas. And Alex Haley used to have a picture in his office showing a turtle sitting on a fence. Pretty weird, and inevitably invited comment. He said that he had it there to remind him of a lesson he'd learned long before. If you see a turtle on a fence, you know he got some help. Haley said this, anytime I start thinking, wow, isn't it marvelous all that I've done, I look at that picture and remember how this turtle, that is me, got up on that post. Now that's how the Christian feels. Not superior, but grateful. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we are amazed by your kindness and mercy that is sure for all who turn to you. I pray, Lord, that all here, whatever background, whatever lives lived, would come to know that mercy for themselves, for your glory's sake.